and some 5 kilometers deep, gouged out when a huge meteor slammed into Mars eons ago. Then there is Valles Marineris, the Grand Canyon of Mars, a gigantic rift in the ground that stretches farther than the distance between Boston and San Francisco, a fracture that is 7 kilometers deep in some places, and so wide that explorers standing on one rim of it cannot see the other side because it is beyond the horizon. The atmosphere of Mars is a mere wisp, thinner than Earth's high stratosphere. It is composed mostly of carbon dioxide, with traces of nitrogen, oxygen, and inert gases such as argon and neon. The air pressure at the surface of Mars is about the same as the pressure of Earth's atmosphere 30-some kilometers up in the high stratosphere, so thin that an uncovered glass of water will immediately boil away even when the temperature is far below zero, which it is most of the time. Mars is a cold world. At midsummer noon on the Martian equator, the ground temperature might get as high as 70 degrees Fahrenheit, but at the level of a person's nose, the temperature would be zero, and that night it would plunge to 100 below or even colder. The thin Martian atmosphere retains almost none of the sun's heat. It re-radiates back into space, even at noon on the equator. There is water on Mars, however. The polar caps that can be seen from Earth, even with an amateur telescope, contain frozen water, usually overlain with frozen carbon dioxide, dry ice. Explorers found layers of permafrost, frozen water, beneath the surface, enough underground water to make an ocean or at least a sizable sea. There is abundant evidence that water once flowed across the surface of Mars. The entire northern hemisphere of the planet may once have been an ocean basin. Mars was once considerably warmer and wetter than it is now. But today the surface of Mars is a barren desert of highly oxidized iron sands that give Mars its rusty red coloration. Those sands are loaded with superoxides. The planet-wide desert of Mars is more like powdered bleach than soil in which plants could grow. Yet there is life on Mars. The first expedition discovered lichen-like organisms living inside cracks in the rocks littering the floor of the Grand Canyon of Mars. The second expedition found bacteria living deep underground, extremophiles that metabolize solid rock and water leached from the permafrost. And the human explorers discovered an ancient cliff dwelling built into a niche high up the north wall of the Valles Marineris. There were once intelligent Martians, but they were wiped out in a cataclysm that scrubbed the entire planet clean of almost all life. Curious explorers from Earth sought to understand those long-vanished Martians, but others of Earth preferred to ignore them, to pretend that they never existed. In an irony that stretched across two worlds, the greatest discovery made on Mars led directly to the determined effort to put an end to the exploration of the Red Planet. Dithonium Chasma, the Rift Valley.
"It's hard to think of this as a valley," said Doreen.
Carlton heard her in the earphones built into his suit's glass-steel helmet. "A rift valley," he said. She made a little frown.
"I've had some geology classes, Professor."
"Please call me Carter."
"Sure."
Her nanosuit was transparent. It looked to Carlton as if she were wearing nothing over her coveralls more than a plastic rain suit with an inflated bubble over her head. Even the life support pack on her back looked too small to do its job, flimsy. Yet she was standing out on the surface of Mars in the morning sunlight, snug and apparently perfectly safe. Carlton felt like a shambling Neanderthal beside her. His spacesuit was a heavy, cumbersome shell of Cermet with flexible joints at the elbows, knees, and waist. "Semi-flexible," he corrected himself. "I'll know what arthritis feels like when it hits me, trying to move around in this outfit." He pictured himself like Falstaff, clanking unwillingly into battle inside his heavy suit of armor. Doreen had volunteered to help him lug his equipment out to the digging site, so he had allowed her to carry the spades and tongs and brushes, while he pushed the cart that was loaded with the explosives and detonators.
She's right, he thought, as he looked past her at the cliffs looming over them. It doesn't look like a valley. They call Mars the Red Planet, he mused as they trudged along to the site. Yes, most of its surface is rust-red dust, iron oxides, a red desert from pole to pole. But look at that cliff face, bands of ochre and pale yellow and light brown along with the iron red. You can't stand here for 10 minutes without wanting to be a geologist. Tithonium Chasma is part of the gigantic Valles Marineris, the incredible slash across the face of Mars. Those cliffs on Carlton's left were more than 3 kilometers high. The valley was so wide that he couldn't see its other wall. It was over the horizon. Several clicks along the cliff face was the sloping ramp of dirt and rocks that Jamie Waterman had used for the first transit down to the floor of Tithonium, back during the first expedition more than 20 years ago. The original Mars base had been up on the plateau in those early days. But it was down here on the valley floor that the Martian lichen had been discovered, struggling to stay alive through frigid nights and dust storms that smothered everything in their path. And in that notch high up in the cliff wall, Waterman had found the ruins of buildings, brick structures erected by intelligent Martians more than 60 million years ago. Intelligent Martians who were wiped out by an extinction-level meteor strike, just as the dinosaurs on Earth had been driven into extinction by a killer meteor impact. There were 3 buckyball cables running along the cliff face now, to carry people and equipment from the base on the valley floor to Waterman's village up in the cleft in the rocks. Only it wasn't a village. Carlton was convinced of that. Some sort of shrine, more likely. Or a fortress. The village was down here on the valley floor. Has to be. If only I could find it. If the damned lichen are smart enough to live down here, where it's warmer and there's some moisture from the frost that forms overnight, then the Martians must have been smart enough to do the same. Except that he hadn't found any village. Not yet, he told himself. It's here. You just haven't gone deep enough yet. Is that the site? Doreen asked, pointing with a spade toward the edge of the pit a few dozen meters ahead. That's it, Carlton said. And you think there's a village buried here? Doreen put down the spade and the bag of brushes. They stopped at the edge of the pit. It was 50 meters across and about 20 meters deep, almost square in shape. Its bottom looked freshly swept, cleaned of all debris and dust, nothing but bare, jagged rock. To one side of where they were standing rested the tables bearing mesh grids for sifting rubble and the hoist that Carlton used to lower himself into the pit. As he carefully took his packages from the cart and lowered them to the ground in his stiff-jointed suit, Carlton said, "Ground-penetrating radar showed indications of a gridwork about 30 meters below the surface. Nature doesn't produce grids. Intelligence does." "But you haven't found anything," Doreen said, not accusingly, he thought. If anything, she sounded sympathetic. "Haven't gone deep enough yet. The village is underneath 60-some million years of compacted dust. If it's here at all," he added silently.
"And you excavate with explosives?"
"Beats digging."
"But doesn't that blow up the fossils you're looking for?"
"I'm not down deep enough for fossils yet. When I find something, I'll start digging by hand."
"Sounds weird, blasting away like that."
He chuckled at her. "There's precedent for it. Dart or Broom or one of those paleontologists in South Africa a century or more ago. They used dynamite to excavate fossil sites."
"It still sounds weird," Doreen insisted gently.
"Don't sweat it," he said. "I sift through the rubble after each blast to see if there's anything in it. So far, nothing. It takes a long time, but digging by hand would be really tedious."
He could see Doreen's face clearly through the nanofabric bubble of her helmet. She looked intrigued, but he thought he saw doubt in her big doe's eyes as well. "You're doing this work all by yourself?"
"Nobody's willing to help me. I'm something of a pariah, you know."
"I've heard about that," Doreen said. "Some sort of scandal. You had to resign your professorship at Penn."
"I was set up. The fundamentalists took control of the Board of Regents, and they didn't like what I had to say about Darwin, so they set me up with a Mata Hari."
"Mata Hari?"
Doreen clearly had never heard of her. A spy, a seducer.